Okay, welcome everybody to season two, episode 20 now of Spiritual Psychotherapy. You know, it's a milestone in a way. And I can't help but feel the irony of the fact that we're not trying to amass hours or episodes or anything like that. We're really just trying to be here now, and we're trying to enjoy ourselves and play the music of spiritual psychotherapy. So whether it's episode one or episode 20, thank you for joining. And I'm honored to share this space with you, and hopefully the energy that emanates from this, and this is my prayer, could be a blessing in your life, and can be a butterfly effect in you know, just the whole universe, and just for goodness and for love and for peace. That's the energy I'd like to bring into this before, you know, we take a break before Pesach. You know, I think it's important to feel into that. And especially, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about world affairs and what's going on with Iran. Baruch Hashem, Am Yisrael is strong, maybe stronger than ever, and we see the might and the amazingness of our military, and thank God to some degree we have the United States as a friend. But may Hashem protect the good people, especially, and you know, may Hashem guide the evil towards goodness. That's the prayer that we
Amen.
can really pray for. All right, so let's dive into Alan Watts. I think this is very much in line with how I feel when I give these lectures. I said, I got to jump into this. It's so good. So Alan Watts says, I believe that the kind of philosophy I'm talking about is more like a medicine than a diet. And you don't want to get hooked on the medicine. It has a specific job to do and then send you away. Of course, if you want to come back for kicks, it's a free country and you always can. But basically, my idea in giving lectures and any kind of philosophical discourse is to set people free from me. It's like a good doctor, right? A good doctor is always trying to get rid of his patients because he knows that there are always an enormous and indefinite supply of people who are going to be sick. And if he gets rid of patients, the patients he gets rid of will recommend those new ones to come, and he'll get rid of them too. And that's my attitude. So why do I begin with this? Well, I find that, you know, when it comes to spirituality and spiritual teachings, it's so easy to make it about my ego. It's so easy. And you know what? From a certain perspective, you could take me and judge me and say, yes, you know, Michael's doing this because he gets a certain amount of praise for it, and there's a certain amount of self-aggrandizement. And I would be fully lying to you if I didn't say and admit that, yes, I do love it. Thank God, I love what I do. And I love the fact that people love me more for it, or people show me more affection because of this connection that we're forming. But I don't think that that necessarily has to be a bad thing. And I think that if you don't realize that that is the case in anything you do, then you're kind of out to lunch. So I'm trying to, as Alan Watts would say, be in touch with my own rascality. I'm trying to be in touch with my own yetzer hara, if you will, in the Hebrew way of saying it, in the sense that, yes, there is a selfishness involved in what I'm doing. But at the same time, I'd like to, you know, almost take a page from Alan Watts's playbook and say, I really hope that you don't get hooked on this in a way. Meaning, I hope you don't become dependent on spiritual psychotherapy to the degree where you keep coming back for it in an addictive way. Rather, I hope and I pray that this could be something that will guide you into the rest of your life where you don't even need this. And we'll see how he expands upon this. He says, Buddha gave the example of his doctrine of the Dharma, or the method of Buddhism. He likened it to a raft for crossing a stream. Here's the raft, you get on it, you cross the stream, you get to the other side. Well, you certainly don't pick up the raft and carry it right with you the rest of the way. But there are a lot of people who, let's say, they're kind of rafty. They love the raft, right? They stay on it, and when they get to the other shore, they go back and pick up a new load and then bring it over again. And there you find all kinds of philosophers and clergy, types of monks and people of that kind who are, shall we say, addicted to religion. But I want to talk to you now about the non-addictive sort of thing. The superior, the finest product of religion is something that doesn't look like religion at all, but is simply the practice of one's life. The religion of no religion. You might say it's like when you get a great artist performing, it looks so easy, he doesn't seem to have any props. When a building is finished, the scaffolding disappears. And so in this way, there are certain people whose religion was like a vanished scaffolding, where they become in a certain way indistinguishable from ordinary people. And yet there's something about them that you can't quite put your finger on. You know there's a difference, right, in them, in their character, in the way that they come off, but you can't quite say what it is. And so in Buddhist philosophy, the superbly enlightened person is likened to, let's say, this verse from Chinese poetry. Entering the forest, he does not disturb a blade of grass. Entering the water, he does not make a ripple. In other words, his spiritual power, his religion, does not stand out like a sore thumb. So just to pause here for a second, you know, even the, you know, Eli, you came on screen while I was just sitting here, you know, the 10 minutes from 8:20 to 8:30 where I'm sitting here and I'm meditating. It's such a beautiful experience for me every week, you know, the pregame almost that I get here, and there's like a certain energy that I feel. And I was thinking of something that Alan Watts had said in a different lecture where he says, we're all like a symptom of the universe. You and I, to feel separate from the universe is kind of the sickness that we suffer from here in the West, especially. But once you feel yourself to be continuous with the universe, an outgrowth of the universe, despite the fact that you're able to walk around on the earth, when you feel yourself to be a part of it the same way that a tree grows out of the earth, no longer do you feel this need to have some kind of self-aggrandizement. It falls away so naturally when you're just content in your own skin, because you don't feel limited to yourself. You feel connected to everything and everyone around you. And you feel you are a symptom of this universe, but not just a symptom of it, you are it. You're all of it. And it's an amazing experience to feel into. And then once you get to that, I think that's when you can really feel into what he's saying here, which is that these types of people, the superbly enlightened Buddhist person, is somebody who is indistinguishable from ordinary people, because he doesn't need to go around and proselytize. He doesn't need to go and make a podcast about it. He doesn't have to write an article about it. He can just go about his daily business with a little bit of a smirk. And like they always say, they asked, I think, Suzuki, what is it like being enlightened? And he says, it's a lot like everyday ordinary consciousness, except about 2 inches off the ground. And that's the experience of it. And once you're able to feel into that, it's not, you don't even have to force yourself to be holy. It's just a natural occurrence that you go about your daily business with humility, with real humility, which is you don't even realize that you're being humble. You're just doing it. You're just doing your thing. That's really humility. Exactly.
I'm being humble because I'm doing it for the sake of
humility. Exactly. Exactly. You cannot be thinking of being humble. And that's why a person who has gotten to this place, when he enters the forest, he doesn't disturb any blade of grass. When he enters the water, it doesn't make a ripple. He doesn't feel the need to call attention to himself. And the reason for that is because he's not identified with small self. He's so overwhelmed with the whole environment of the forest that he's like, why would I call attention to little small self? If anything, that's painful, because that makes me limited to right over here, just this body over here. But once, now that I realize I am the whole scenery around me, I'm all my five senses, including my entire visual field, I am that. Why call attention to little me in the corner? When I'm this whole thing, I'm every blade of grass that I can see. I'm all the wind around me. I'm the galaxy and all the stars. I don't feel the need then to seek praise from people. And that's the beauty. That's the level that you can kind of unlock when you get into this. And he says here, there's a kind of anonymity to it. So I wrote here in parentheses, ryokan. You know, there's another lecture where Alan Watts talks about ryokan, and he was one of these Zen masters where you didn't feel judged in his presence, similar to what we were saying about Carl Jung, where ryokan had this purity about him. He had this innocence about him, but at the same time, despite and maybe even because of that purity, you know, there are some religious leaders where you're in their presence and you feel inadequate because they're so holy. Because it's almost like a tacit judgment on their part that they're so holy that you're not quite at their level, and therefore you have so much of a ways to go. But with a guy like ryokan, there was something about his presence where you felt that he was looking at you kind of with this smile in his eye, like almost like the Hindus would say, "Come now, Shiva, I know who you are." Like he looks at you and he says, "Wow, this person is just the universe deluding itself into thinking that it's a little old person. But really, I know that you are just one of the many manifestations of God, one of the many faces of God." And a person who can look at you that way, you have no choice but to feel like, wow. You feel like a natural phenomenon. You feel like a cloud. You feel like a blade of grass. Nobody judges a cloud for not being nice enough. You're a natural phenomenon. So he says, I remember once a great Japanese artist had done a piece of calligraphy for me. And it was amazing. He had just written on a hanging scroll, a kakemono, he calls it, but he had done it very skillfully. Now I was very pleased with it, says Alan Watts. And I hung it up in my office. And just in the next few days, the great Zen scholar, Professor Suzuki, was going to pay a visit to us. And I told this artist, well, I'm going to hang it up and it's going to be there when Professor Suzuki comes. And the artist said, I hope he won't notice it. That's what he says about his own work. In other words, that it should be something so compatible and so congenial with the whole environment that it doesn't stand out like a sore thumb. So, in that same way, a person's religion can be something that becomes them. Like when you say, oh, that's very becoming to you, it just kind of fits with you. And we talk about art in Zen very often is, you know, in Western art, you look and the main part of the portrait is the person, and then you see a little bit of the background. But if you look in like a lot of Zen art, it's incredible. The vast majority of what you're seeing is the environment, and then maybe somewhere off in the corner you'll see a person. And that's a much more realistic view of what the universe is because we're so tiny. It puts everything in perspective. And you are kind of becoming of the environment. Meaning you fit in. You don't stick out like a sore thumb. But in the West, so often we have this need to be seen, to be heard. And you wonder why when you watch baseball, the Japanese pitcher, he could pitch a, you know, an out of a crazy jam and he'll barely show any emotion. Because for him, he's part of a team. It's not about his personal ego. He's like, yeah, I'm just doing my job. I'm just doing my tafkid. And in the same way, a person who's in this Zen state of mind, when he's not so wrapped up as in his own small identified self, and he's so feeling of the environment and feels so connected with the world around him, he feels that he is becoming of this environment. And therefore, my religion doesn't have to be something that stands out. If anything, it makes me more smooth with everything and everyone around me. So now Watts finishes off here. He says, I am not trying to convert you. I'm not trying to do you any good. I'm just doing my own stuff. I talk this way like birds sing. It amuses me. I enjoy it because I'm interested. I'm full of wonder about this universe and full of all sorts of thoughts about it. And I like to share these with people, not in order to interfere with your personal lives or to make you dependent on me. Heaven forbid. If I had enough people dependent on me, I would have no sleep at all at nights. I'd be on the phone, there'd be people hanging around, and I'd say, go away. So I love this. He's got it exactly right. If anything, you realize that fame is actually a big form of a curse. That's the way I started to see it. Being famous, you just become the butt of everybody's attention now. And everybody's kind of letting you know how much of an ego you are. You become even more wrapped up in your limited sense of self. And being famous, you're just a lot more susceptible to being ridiculed. And even though, yeah, there's a lot of praise and there's probably a lot of pleasure from that praise, there's also probably an equal amount of blame and insult and shame that they'll give you. And the real chokhmah, the real wisdom, is to be the kind of person where you're just doing your thing. And you don't have to necessarily be famous, but you're part of a greater whole. You're part of a system that appreciates you and makes you feel larger than yourself. That's really what we're going for here. And the feeling of being larger than yourself is actually not really going to happen when you become too famous, because then you just become ego again and again and again and again. And everyone keeps reminding you what you're an ego, you're an ego, you're an ego. Whereas if you're just doing your thing and nobody's there to keep reminding you of it, you're just vibing with people. That's the goal, I think, in a lot of ways. And in a lot of ways, we're already there. That's the beauty of it. We're here right now. This is what we're doing. But I love the way he talks about this. And when he says, when I give a lecture, it's not me trying to proselytize you, says Alan Watts. I'm doing this the same way that a bird sings, the same way that a cloud formation looks the way it does. I am a natural phenomenon. And part of the nature of me is to just give these lectures. And this is so inspiring to me, because this helps unlock me personally from the ego games that I can play with myself when I give a lecture like this. How, yeah, you're saying like to put you to be the one that's giving the lecture. In a way, I can't help it. I'm one of the most talkative people that I know. That's true too. That's true too. And but on the one hand, the helping of the other people is extremely pleasurable to me. So I know that there's a selfishness to it. But at the same time, yeah, it's at the same time, you could look at anything in the whole world from multiple perspectives. You could look at anything from the perspective of selfishness, which can be true from that lens. And you could look at anything from the perspective of love. And it'll be true from that lens. And the difficulty is, of course, when you reach the extremes of hate, how do you see love within hate? And then when you see the extremes of love, how do you see selfishness within love? Well, it's really all the perspective that you take. You could be walking down the street and everything is love, and somehow even the worst of the worst falls into that love. It's an experience to have, you know?
Michael, can I say something?
Hey, please, Eli.
I think there's one word that you didn't say, but I think it's relevant, and it's authenticity. It's being authentic. I don't know if it's selfish. I mean, you love these classes. Guess what? I got to love them. And I don't know if it's, I don't think it's a selfish thing, but it's just, this is you being you. And I think there's something about you being you that brings you great joy, because that's the soul. When you're doing what you love, what you're doing, when you live from your soul, there's a joy in that. And I don't know if that's selfish. I think that's just authentic. Alan Watts is coming from his soul. He's giving his lectures because this is what he's meant to do. So just like, and it's a part of the natural world or the natural order of things. When you're connected to your soul, you're going to do things that's going to bring you great joy, because joy comes from the soul. So, when you give these talks or whatever you do, when you feel that joy, it's because you're connecting to your soul, I think. I don't know if there's any selfishness involved. I mean, obviously you want to share what you have, but that, I think those are all great, wonderful, incredible qualities. So
Thank you.
I
Thank
would
you
just
for
say
giving me
there's
a positive
soul.
perspective. I'm just saying that, like, from the cynical perspective, which you can always take, anyone can always take a cynical perspective, which is okay. You can look at anything in the whole world as being selfish. With that aside, I think what you're saying is extremely beautiful and very well received. And thank you. You're giving me a lot of insight here, which is, this is why I love spiritual psychotherapy, because it's psychotherapy for me, especially. If it also is for you, I'm so happy. But this is really therapy for me, Eli. So thank you for saying that, where I see what you're saying, where when I'm being really genuine and I'm singing my own song the way that I know how to do it, and I'm speaking from my soul, that's when it's something that's probably going to resonate with other people. And that's when it's going to feel good for me. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. And the sad part is not even the sad part, it's something I learned from. But there have been times in my life where people do accuse me. And I'm actually, this is part of some of the talking points I wanted to get to. But there are times where people accuse me of being, very self-aggrandizing, or attempting to be the center of attention. And you know what? It's probably true from some perspective and to some degree. But at the same time, what I've learned is that the person criticizing almost always has at least an equal amount of work to do as I do in that scenario.
No.
First of all, it doesn't even matter exactly. It's not my business about their work. But just noticing that they have work to do allows me to realize it's not fully personal. The degree of their anger is definitely not for me to personalize. They can't help it, exactly, because they're
Helping
hurting
the
in some
whole
way.
system, if you zoom out of it,
Exactly.
it's like the positive to the negative, it's or the opposite, really, the negative to the
Yeah.
positive. Or someone else is going to say that. It's
Yeah,
what you
yeah, yeah,
always
yeah.
say. It's like that general concept
100%.
of things being dual in a way.
100%. Absolutely. You
But
can't avoid it.
there's a certain level of, I mean, I feel like not personal to you. It's just the way things work. Is that, of course, what do you want to call it? That
Perspective angle,
perspective
yeah.
is going to come towards you no matter time.
Absolutely.
But
And
you shouldn't get affected by
it's
it. You
thank
should
you for
try.
saying that.
You're human. I don't know if I would
No,
take it
no, no.
personally.
It's always a learning experience, and the feedback that I
Yeah,
take
of
from
course.
it, and there are times where I take, let's say, 99% of it and I throw it out, but there is 1% of gold in there sometimes.
Right,
But
sometimes.
sometimes 99% of it is really just that person had low blood
That's the
sugar.
dangerous part.
So you kind of decide how much of the feedback you want to accept. And the beauty is, from that experience, you learn more about your relationship with that person, and you learn more about your way of interacting with the whole universe. And you ask yourself, okay, why did it bother me so much that this person yelled at me? And
Right.
that's the work. And the more you're able to give up, the more you really grow from it. Give it up. So that's why one of my talking points here, I will skip to this one first. I wrote you praise and blame. And what I want to say about this is, it's so beautiful to me when somebody gives me a call, or they shoot me a text or something, and they tell me how much they enjoyed something that I put out there into the world. It gives me great pleasure, and it really is, it lights me up. It fills me up with really a lot of happiness. Like today, my mom called me. Some doctor that I worked with last month spoke very highly of me. That feels good. It's very nice. Oh, somebody said something nice about me. The thing that the Buddhism teaches me is, don't cling to that. Do not cling to the praise that people give you. Because if you do, then you also are going to naturally end up clinging to, or really having a ton of aversion to, the blame and the criticisms. Because they're two sides of the same coin. You cannot have one without the other. So you can feel the praise and let it wash through you and appreciate it, and then let it go. And don't cling to it as an aspect of your identity and make a whole complex about, my value now rests in the good things that people say about me. That's not a healthy way of really interacting with the world, because it's so fickle. It's something that will disappear in a second. How many rabbis in the community do we know of? One day they're, everyone's talking about them, like they're the best thing since sliced bread. And it's like politics. And then the next moment, oh, they said something that's not as good, or they're not as popular, or blah, blah, blah. It's something, when you realize this, you learn to not take anything personal. You don't take the praise personally, and you don't take the criticisms personal. And I really feel that this has been a guiding light for me because no longer am I subject to the very mercurial vicissitudes of the world that are always shifting. And I could just be present, like, all right, and by the way, certain qualities that I might exude, very often one person will really like that, and they'll hit it off with, like, let's say me being high energy, especially in the morning after my morning coffee, versus the other person who's very kind of like calm type of person, more of an introvert, and then they get annoyed at me because I'm talking too much. The first guy was so happy that I was being talkative and we were hitting it off and we were dacking, we were laughing, we were lighting up the room. The other guy is sitting there pissed off because he felt he didn't get enough time to talk. Who's right and who's wrong? The answer is there's no absolute here. One guy's going to criticize me for the exact same reason that the other guy has praised me. And it's not an absolute. It's not God judging you absolutely for good and evil. And that's why the Taoism and the Zen and the mindfulness is just telling you, be present for the praise, be pleasant for the blame, and let it go. Don't identify with it.
You
Right?
know,
So,
Michael,
yeah.
but if you're you, if you're authentic, then it doesn't matter. And like you said, someone will praise you for the same thing that another person blames you for,
Yep.
but that's their interaction. But when you're centered, when you're coming from your soul, the unique Michael, not the small Michael, but not a transcendent all, but there's something in between, which is an authentic soul self. And that's where you have your gifts, because you can't be the transcendent all the time. You got to live in this world. I mean, we were not meant to be, otherwise why you come to Earth for? You come to learn lessons, you come to grow, and there's a neshama that is authentic to you, and no one has that. No one has the unique, just same way. The same way you have a face or that no one has, or a body type or whatever, no one looks like you. You're not a twin. There's an authenticity and an individuality that's a spiritual thing. It's not an ego thing. And when you're in touch with that, it gives you a tremendous amount of strength, inner strength, where praise, blame, all the same. That's
How
the
you are.
quote.
I love
You
that.
know,
I love
praise, blame,
that.
all the same. That's what they say. And a lot of these gurus, not only that, but they will, Maharaji used to torment the people around him and scold them, and there was a badge of honor because, he was very, very tough with Dada, for example. He was, and because he just wanted to just let him get rid of his ego. I mean, when you get to a point where you're just happy to be in his presence and all the tirades. Now, it's funny, I'll give you an example. I had a manager in real estate, my first job in real estate, and this guy was just he was like a cartoon character. He
Oh,
was
man.
so outrageous in the things that he said that I didn't take him seriously 90% of the time, but other people did. That he made them cry, like he was so tough, but he had a good heart, but his bark was bigger than his bite. But he was like that. He was just so outrageous that I didn't take him seriously. Most of the time, I wasn't perfect, and I did. There was times that I let him get to me, but most of the time, I just rolled off my back because it was so funny.
I'm a person who grew up very much like a people pleaser, and this really resonates with me because, when you grow up that way and you're very codependent, as we say, there's a certain amount of codependent recovery to go through to really be healthy and to really, it's almost like a reparation of and a repair of your relationship with God and with the universe, where this whole time you're not really being your natural self. You were always just thinking what will please other people. And there comes a point where you have to say, to hell with that, screw that. I'm going to be doing what is good for me because I see that really everything I do is in a way selfish. So let me stop playing these games where I'm doing things for other people because it's good for me. Let me do what's like directly good for me and be honest about that with other people and see where this aligns with other people and where it doesn't align. We can talk about it. But I'm not going to be doing everything just for the sake of pleasing others. And when you're talking about a curriculum, I agree. And I think at the same time, like I always say, The curriculum is to learn that all along there was nothing to learn. Somehow, that was what there was to learn. And it's a part of that reverse psychology almost. I wrote over here one of my notes, love the ego. So often where I wrote this while I was, I think, meditating at one point, and so often we're trying to transcend the ego. So often we're trying to let go of this small sense of self because it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good. Like we're saying, it feels good to feel connected and identified with the whole environment so much so that you don't even need have this desire for praise. That's the ideal. So we have this desire to overcome ourselves, which makes no sense because the one who wants to overcome is the ego itself. So I think if I've ever learned anything from logotherapy, from Viktor Frankl, who survived the Holocaust, the beautiful book, Man's Search for Meaning, there's a reverse psychology that we can play with ourselves. And I think is very much part of the spirit of Maharaji and Ram Dass and a lot of these more loving people is love the ego. When you can just, even though it's an illusion, ultimately, even though I would say love it. I would say love it. Don't indulge too much. Don't become, grandiose on me here. But at the same time, you can love yourself, love the perceived self, and then let it go.
Where's the balance? If you let go of your ego, then you're a people pleaser also.
What do you mean?
Meaning, I'm not saying this towards you, I'm saying in general, if someone has to let, like,
I
if you
think
want
I
to
know where you're
release your,
going.
yeah, if you release your ego completely, then how are you going to take care of yourself? You're
So
not thinking about yourself.
exactly.
But I
I
know
don't
it's
think
not the
that that
case, so
means
what,
that.
how do you solve
How
that?
do you solve that? The
Okay,
word
you
that comes
got
to
it.
mind, and exactly where you're going with this, the word that comes to mind for me is spontaneity. When you don't have an ego in all moments planning things out, there's a spontaneity and a naturalness of what's going to flow for you.
But sometimes that spontaneity leads to being a people pleaser throughout, your entire life, because that's what comes to you. But there's a certain point where you have to take a course of action on putting the mask on yourself
And I
once
think
again.
that's going to happen spontaneously as well. It's hard
It's
to put into
tricky.
words. It's hard to put into words,
Obviously, you have to do both, but
but it's
I
a practice. It's a
right.
practice of being in the moment and seeing what feels good.
Maybe just being anav and emet is
Yeah,
part of it. I don't
I
know.
think that will naturally guide you. But it's you, like you're saying, it's not something we could ever
I don't think
really
you put it in the words.
put into words. It's 100% not.
Okay.
So love the ego in the sense of if you really want to overcome it, stop trying to overcome it. Just fully accept it and love it. And then it'll reveal itself to not be a thing, to not be an absolute. It's a stream of thoughts and emotions that you created into a picture of who you are. But really, it's a stream.
But you're saying love it from an outside view. You're looking in, loving it. You're not, engulfed by it. You're not blinded by it. You're saying,
Exactly,
I get what you're
exactly.
saying. It's very smart.
It's don't identify with it
You're
while
saying
giving it the love.
I accept it
And
almost.
the same thing with any dark thought, any dark thought, any dark emotion, which, like I said, every human being, if you are a human being, has, is to give love to that love, that emotion. That's what, I was in Maine and I went on a long walk. And basically, I'm listening to Ram Dass. And he says, I love my dark thoughts. I said, that's it. That's it. And it's a thought. That's all it is. It's just a thought. And when you learn to do that, it holds so much less power over you. He says, it's like what used to bother me now, he says, it's like I invited into the room for tea. Have a seat. Let's talk. And then it sees itself out on its own. It no longer becomes an obsessive, repetitive, autopilot thing, disparaging you over and over
If you
again.
love it, then why not feed it? If you love the dark thought, then
Ah, so
why
there's
wouldn't you naturally feed it if it's an
so
if dark thought
love
feeding
doesn't
itself?
mean to indulge. Love means to give it mindfulness. The same way we talk about loving God being through just mindfulness. I think the same thing here with loving your dark thoughts is just the same way a little mo a mother comforts a little baby, like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, is the same way all these emotions and thoughts, they just want to be held for a second. They just want to be, instead of continuing to push them away and ignore them. They want to be felt and heard and then let go of. Yeah. So next talking point I wrote here, using Buddhism to ignore good and evil. I've encountered quite a few people in my life, and I often discuss this in the realm of like Israel versus Hamas, but it could come up in anything where people very often try to use Buddhism to fully ignore good and evil. And they say, well, because Buddhism is trying to tell me to stop seeing the world in terms of good and evil, craving and aversion, and therefore it's all just the soup of oneness, and let me not even care about good and evil. Well, that's going against your natural, spontaneous human intuitions about the world. And if you're doing that, you're creating a totally different type of complex. I find the left wing is very good at doing this. And when I say good, I mean it's a bad thing. That they're very good at trying to force themselves in the opposite direction of their very normal, natural human intuitions about what sanctity is. Where we have natural feelings about maybe we shouldn't just be anyone feeling like they could dress up and identify as and have sex with whoever the hell they want. And yet that's what's happening. And the left has convinced itself that that stuff is so okay that it's the best and it's great. And they're forcing themselves away from the natural intuition about what reality is. And then they're just creating these crazy complexes for themselves. Whereas it would be much more healthy to, you know, still play the game of the tradition that we have while knowing, okay, it's maybe it's not so serious per se, but it is important in some way to follow the natural intuitions of that human beings have about what does it mean for things to be sanctified. I think this is a really important point. Eli, thank you for sending me that podcast about Dipama, really a beautiful Zen master in a way. And you know, the thing that struck me from that podcast was, she said, I always have three things in my consciousness at all times: concentration, loving kindness, and peace. Jack Kornfield asked her at one point, he says, what are you thinking of? She said, just those three things. It's what I keep in my mind all the time, keeping it really in my consciousness all the time: concentration, loving kindness, and peace. And if you, I know it's simple, but if you simplify it to that and you just kind of remind yourself of that in whatever you're doing, fill yourself with concentration, loving kindness, and peace. I think, and I hope we'll find that things flow. Things are peaceful. Things are loved and loving when we allow ourselves to be almost filled up with these energies at any time.
Well, Michael, can I say one thing? She she has a fascinating story
mm-hmm.
because she was a householder. She was married. She had a lot of suffering. Her husband died. Her child died. She was bedridden. And she really came to the path very late in life, so to speak. And but she was a natural. Once she started meditating, she was like a powerhouse. And, you know, she, and it's, if you read her book, it just goes into it. She was just a natural, and yeah, she became enlightened, and she was a master. I mean, and she would bless people, and all the cities she had it'll blow your mind. Some of the stories. I mean, but it's really her energy. And how it affected the people around her.
Yeah,
you could really feel it from the book. That's why I have her in my wallet.
It's the one. The same thing. It's the same thing with Maharaji, where you know, it's not about the stories of the powers, and that's very nice and that's very cool and that's interesting when you hear about it. But the real thing is, what was the feeling when reading this? What was the feeling of the people around her? Did they feel that they were filled with concentration, loving kindness, and peace? Or did they feel constantly, oh, I need to be on my best behavior because I'm being judged right now? And what did they learn from this experience of being in her presence? And this next line here that I wrote is also from her. she would go up to people and they would ask her questions about complex things and, questions about how to become enlightened. And she would simply ask them, "Do you see the mystery right now? In this moment, right now, can you look at me and realize what a mystery all of this is? If you can, then you got it." That's it. In any given moment, realize with humility that it's a tremendous mystery and we have no idea what's going on right now.
Let it go.
And let it go. It's all a mystery. And we're all here to laugh about it and play this game. And the key, I think, in a lot of ways, is don't try to solve it. There's nothing to solve. The mystery itself is the beautiful thing. Alan Watts talks about when he grew up, there was this forest, a kind of distant in his visual field, and he would always wonder what's in that forest, what's in that forest. And he went up to it one day, and he was about to go in there, and he decided, you know what? I don't want to go into that forest. I want it to maintain its mystery, its mystique. And life, in a way, always has that. We have no idea what the hell's going on here. And that's part of the beauty. Great. And I said here also, embrace and then let go of any external meanings. Similar to what I said about praise. I said here, there will always come a point where this is too self-referential and overwhelming. So sometimes we try to find our own personal meanings to life. And I find very often when people talk about their personal relationship with God, which is such a beautiful and important and necessary thing, because we are human beings. During that experience, people will form very, very individual and unique connections to the universe. And the problem can sometimes become when they cling to this. When this becomes something like a hill that they die on, that meaning that I felt with God on that day, with the day, and it becomes something they can't let go of. So I'm not telling you don't love those experiences and don't embrace. I'm saying embrace them. Embrace whatever you consider the meaning of your life in any given moment. But then let go of it. Because if you cling too strongly to it, it might drive you towards in an extreme in a, in its extremist form. It's sorry, in its most extreme form, it might drive you towards paranoia or grandiosity, something I see all the time. People who become really psychotic, the problem becomes they can't let go of unique meanings in their life. And if they would have been taught Buddhism, it would have been like the best, easiest purification and cure for all of this. Where it's like, oh, that was nice when it happened, and then I let it go. And now I don't have to die on that hill. I don't have to fully cling to the experience that I had in Joshua Tree or in this place, and oh, that I'm the unique son of God, and that I know I'm God loves me because of this and this and that. Or I know God was teaching me this and that because of this and this experience. When you become too much enmeshed in that, trust me, it's going to become so paranoid and so overwhelming. In some, maybe in some future time, you're going to wish you kind of were able to just let it go. So don't ignore it. Allow it to naturally and spontaneously arise and embrace it and love it, and then let it go and come back to the moment. And stop continually trying to be special in God's eyes. Because you know what? You already are special without trying to be so. The more you try to be special and insist on it and continue to tell everybody how special you are because God did this and this for you, the more it's going to come back to bite you in the you know where. That's my humble perspective on it, at least from what it is for me. Oh, this is an interesting one. I was talking about it with my friend. Finding the good in dark people and revealing the rascality in good people. I find one of the biggest pleasures in life is when you have somebody who's like a Sabra on the one hand, right? They're very rough around the edges. And they're really like, at first glance, and when you first, maybe the first couple of times when you get to know them, and they're almost conscious of it themselves, and they present themselves as like pretty evil. They think they're evil and they say, oh, I'm no good. Don't try to look to me for goodness and niceness. And then peeking through the cracks, once in a while, you get a little glimpse into their softness and their sweetness. And you know, you look at the yin and yang symbol, and you see that the black has a little dot of white in it, and the white has a little dot of black in it. And when you see that, like, wow, this guy who I thought was such a prickly person, he's really got a pretty sweet spot to him. Psychiatrist that I work with, guy is really a hard ass. Like, first impression, terrible. You meet this guy, you don't want to have anything to do with the guy. And then you see once in a while, the way he talks to a patient is so beautiful. The amount that he went the extra mile for this person, like behind closed doors, and he's almost like embarrassed of it because it goes against his persona as this mean guy. But he's got that. And there's a beauty in that. And then the opposite, quote unquote, good people. People who probably are not so in touch with their own shadow element. People who are just, you know, like the quintessential person that you say, oh, everyone says he's a sadiq, he's a sadiq, he's a sadiq. Everyone likes to say that about that person. There's something so much fun about laughing at a dirty joke with that person or getting him to laugh at something like that. Getting him to realize or her to realize his or her own shadow element is a very beautiful thing. And I think this has to do a lot with the balance of the universe, the balance of yin and yang, helping people unlock themselves and get in touch with all parts of themselves instead of clinging to an identity as I'm good or I'm evil or I'm this or I'm that. There's a pleasure in all these types of relationships. The final talking point before we do some Zen koans. I wrote here, a concept closest to God in Buddhism. So I find that a lot of Westerners, when we learn about Buddhism, we try to say, oh, no, okay, so now that Buddhism doesn't have a God concept in it, for me to have a concept of God is something I need to get rid of, or it's something where I'm not really seeing reality clearly and I'm still primitive. And this is the way that we're kind of looked at, either by ourselves or by other people, when we feel like we're learning the Eastern philosophy. I'd like to dispel this notion from you and make you realize, like I really try to emphasize over and over again in a lot of these classes, which is that it's part of Zen to believe in God, for a Westerner especially, because it's spontaneous, it's natural, it's part of your intuition towards the world, being the human being that you are. Where I would say to try to go against that is not really Zen. To try to go against the intuition that you have, that there's a creator and that you are the creature. To try to go against that in certain scenarios is extremely not spontaneous, not natural, and not Zen, if you can even say that. And the desire to push that away is just building a bigger complex. Now, how can I prove this to you from Buddhism itself? Well, within Buddhism, you have the classic type of, you know, mindfulness, self-generated enlightenment, and there's certain names for these types of schools, and that's the classic stuff we always quote, where it's like a guru and a student, and the student is constantly trying to lift himself up by his own bootstraps, and he's trying to enlighten himself, and only finally, once he realizes the futility of this after however many attempts at going crazy trying to enlighten himself, does he finally get it when he gives up. There's another type of school within Buddhism called the Pure Land School of Buddhism, where they have this legend that there was a certain Buddha called Buddha Shakyamuni, who many eons ago, he made a vow. He said, any human being that's still alive at any point in the history of humanity for all time, any human being that pronounces my name, Namu Amida Buddha, and he says it in pure faith, I'll kind of save him, quote unquote. I'll be him. He'll be enlightened through me. And this is a whole school of Buddhism that's very popular in Japan today. And it's basically the same thing as the idea of grace in the Western religions that we have. In the idea of Hashem, save me from the outside. And there's a, like a mahloket even within Buddhism. So it's basically like the concept of God within Buddhism. The concept of the power from the outside, where I couldn't do it on my own. Where, by the way, if you realize it, it's actually the same in both schools. Because the first school was self-generated up until the degree where you realize you can't generate it by yourself, and then you get it. Whereas the second one from the very beginning says, well, I need something from the outside. It can't come from my own ego. So this, the reason I mention all this is really just to allow you to give up any shame that you might have for believing in God. Any shame that you might have towards this concept of, oh, I'm just a primitive Westerner who, you know, I can't help it. I believe in a deity outside myself, a separate external God. People scorn that and spurn that. And I'm saying, no, that's ridiculous. Whatever is naturally arising for you within your own psychology, within your relationship with the universe, with God, I think is normal and natural. And it could be found in different terminologies within different religions. And don't think that Buddhism is atheistic, is what I'm really trying to say, because it's not. And anyone who tries to say that, I think, really has a pretty bad misunderstanding of what Buddhism is, because atheism is a concept, and Buddhism is not about a concept. So it's not about the concept of a God, and it's also not about the concept of no God. It's just the experience of it. Right? All right. Any questions or comments before we move on? Our beauty. So let's do a few koans, and then we'll do a little bit of the Lost Princess before we break for Pesach. This one is called The Voice of Happiness. After Banke had passed away, a blind man who lived near the master's temple told a friend, "Since I am blind, I cannot watch a person's face, so I must judge his character by the sound of his voice. Ordinarily, when I hear someone congratulate another upon his happiness or success, I also hear a secret tone of envy. When condolence is expressed for the misfortune of another, I hear pleasure and satisfaction, as if the one condoling was really glad that there was something left to gain in his own world. In all my experience, however, Banke's voice was always sincere. Whenever he expressed happiness, I heard nothing but happiness. And whenever he expressed sorrow, sorrow was all I heard." So I think in a lot of ways, this might induce some shame in us when we hear that, wow, I could never be like Banke. I could never be a person that's so fully happy for my friend, because there's always a little bit of jealousy inside me. And if I'm not in touch with that, I'm not really in touch with my shadow element. And it's just a natural part of who we are. And when you're competing with somebody, you might sometimes be happy that something didn't really go their way. And you might sometimes be sad that something did go their way. And that's a very normal part of the shadow element. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a state of mind you could get to where that's possible to really feel happy for another. And I think it has a lot to do with stopping to identify, like we began the class with small self. And when you feel yourself to be larger than yourself, you're no longer caught up in your own selfish, small conception of what's good and evil for yourself. And you stop seeing the universe through that lens. And I think a guy like Banke was at that level. Next one is called Open Your Own Treasure House. Daiju visited the master Basso in China. Basso asked, "What do you seek?" "Enlightenment," replied Daiju. "You have your own treasure house. Why do you search outside?" Basso asked. Daiju inquired, "Where is my treasure house?" Basso answered, "What you are asking me is your treasure house." Daiju was enlightened. Ever after, he urged his friends, "Open your own treasure house and use those treasures." I think this is so interesting, where a person here is asking for enlightenment. He's looking outside himself for this enlightenment. And the master tells him, "Why are you looking outside? Look inwardly for that enlightenment." He's like, "I don't even know what inward enlightenment is." He's like, "Even you asking that question is part of that inner enlightenment. And then he got it. Once you realize that anything you say and anything you think is part of it, that's when you get it. It's all part of the stream. Not just the feeling of I got it. Even the feeling of I don't got it is part of the stream. I think that was really interesting. The next one is called Inch Time Foot Gem. A Lord asked Takuan, a Zen teacher, to suggest how he might pass the time. He felt his day very long, attending his office and sitting stiffly to receive the homage of others. Takuan wrote 8 Chinese characters and gave them to the man. Not twice this day. Inch time, foot gem. This day will not come again. Each minute is worth a priceless gem. I love this because it really shows you what mindfulness can make it feel like. This is Arichut Yamim. Arichut Yamim is the experience of my day was long. My day was meaningful. I lived out each moment like it was a priceless gem. Each experience. Arichut Yamim, in the Torah, it says that if you kabed davicha v'etimecha lema'ani arichun yamecha. There's 2 other times that it says it. It also says it regarding Shilua Hakan, right? When you're sending away the bird, the mother bird. And also when it comes to not cheating in business, right? Lo yelecha even va'aven v'arachta yamim. It says in the end of Devarim, and I think it's Ki Tetzeh. So those 3 mitzvot are linked to this idea of arichut yamim, but just the idea of this day is not going to come again. This moment's not going to come again. When you build a society that's enriched with these values of respecting your parents, of respecting motherhood by sending away the mother bird, of being honest in business, you're going to create a society that feels like it's just peaceful and serene. And I think the serenity that is invested in that environment is going to feel pretty priceless, like a gemstone in each moment. So we'll pause here to jump to the Lost Princess for a few minutes. And I'm sorry we don't have so much time. I think this has been a really therapeutic session, even though we didn't necessarily cover so much of the content. I think it's been extremely meaningful so far. So let's do a little bit of the Lost Princess before we got to let you guys go. So we left off last time talking about the princess told the viceroy, and we said the princess is like Shekhinah, and the viceroy is like the Yesod and Tiferet, and she's telling him, okay, if you go a full year yearning for me, and you know the last day you fast and you go without sleep for a 24-hour period, then you'll find me. So the viceroy went and did exactly what she told him. On the last day, at the end of the year, he fasted and did not sleep. Then he stood up and was headed toward the castle. And he saw a tree with very, very beautiful apples. It was very desirable to the eyes, and he ate an apple. As soon as he ate the apple, he immediately fell asleep. And he slept a very long time. So what does this remind you of? That someone is tempted. He sees a tree, ta'avahu la'inayim, right? It's something that's desirable to the eyes. Of course, I'm talking about Adam HaRishon. It was very desirable to the eyes. This was the test of the first humans. Adam and Hava had the chance to rescue the king's daughter. It's saying, already from the beginning of time, this epic story that we're telling about you and me was already the human condition from the very beginning of time. And that's what Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel calls God in search of man. God has been seeking us out in this way since he created humanity. And the idea of being asleep, that he fell asleep after eating this apple and slept a very long time. What does that mean? This is the loss of a higher state of consciousness. This is reflected in the Torah where during the 10 generations from Adam to Noah, essentially nothing of significance happened. It is as if the human race was in a state of sleep during this time, says the commentary here. And it's really very much a part of our own psyche. It's the time in our lives, or the times in our life, where we feel not so connected. where we feel like we're just indulging in those pleasures without, you know, and it's almost an addictive nature without really being present with what life is like. The servant is not affected by this. What, you know, the viceroy's servant, the servant represents the intellect. The person fell into desire, so his intellect tried to wake him. During the second sleep, the servant did not try to wake him. So during this first time that this viceroy failed, at least his intellect was still awake. At least his servant was trying to awaken him, right? So his servant tried to wake him up, but could not. When he finally woke him up, he asked the servant, "Where in the world am I?" The servant told him exactly what had happened. "You slept for a very long time, for many years. I survived by eating this fruit." The viceroy was very upset. He went to the castle and found the princess. She lamented to him, "If you had come directly on that day, you would have freed me from here. But because of one day, you lost everything. But it is very difficult not to eat, especially on the last day, when the evil urge is very strong. Now find yourself a place again and remain there for another year. This time you are permitted to eat on the last day, but you may not sleep. Do not drink any wine on that day so that you will not fall asleep. The main thing is avoiding sleep." Right, the viceroy went and did as she instructed him on the last day. As he was heading toward the castle, he saw a flowing spring. It was red in color and smelled like wine. He asked his servant, "Do you see this? It's a spring and should contain water, but it has a red color and smells like wine." The viceroy went and took a taste from the spring, and he immediately fell asleep for many years. He remained asleep for 70 years. So just a few words about this. Now, the main thing, in order to free the Shekhinah, one must be in a proper state of consciousness. Don't go to sleep. And he was heading toward the castle. What does this mean? He was going toward Malchut. And this is speaking really about Noah, right? We had the first sin was of Adam HaRishon. Now this is the sin of Noah. We know Noah, Vayita, Noah, Ish, Hasadeh, Karem, right? He planted a vineyard in the Torah, it says, and he got drunk and his son saw him naked. Very strange episode in the Torah. This is hinting at that. And the vineyard that he planted represents Malchut, right? So it's the seeking out of Malchut and Shekhinah. Wine can help a person reach the correct state of consciousness to interact with Malchut. This is why we make Kiddush on wine on the Shabbat, but misused or forbidden wine has the opposite effect. So it's interesting here, the way that they talk about wine, where wine could be something that's mesameach, something that's part of the enjoyment of Shabbat, but when it's misused, the way Noah unfortunately encountered it, that's something that's very dangerous, and it puts you right to sleep. Spiritually and literally.
What does that mean? You get a little buzz but not drunk? What's the...
I think everything in moderation. Yeah. Kind of like that, right? So he saw a flowing spring. A spring is usually a means of purification, so it usually should represent something that could be of help to him. But the evil urge is always trying to disguise evil as good. That's what's going on here. There's always a rationalization we can make. Always to get back into an addiction. To get back into pleasure seeking, to get back into an escapism. So this time, you know, he's asking his servant this time a question. The first time when he ate the apple, he didn't even say anything to the servant. Now the viceroy is saying to the servant, "Oh, did you see the spring? Da, da, da." So he's discussing it with his servant. What does this indicate? His servant is his intellect and his logic. And now this is really dangerous. Why is this dangerous? When you start to employ your intellect and your logic as part of a formalistic reasoning to do something that's forbidden, you're really on a way to downfall. And at least in the first sin, he did it without intellectualizing about it. He fell for desire. He took the eighth apple. Now he's becoming all high and mighty. Now he's becoming, "Look at me, I'm an intellectual. And I'm going to sin, but I'm going to do it thinking that I'm correct." He's being self-righteous about it. And now this is really dangerous. How many college students are giving themselves some kind of philosophical basis for why it's okay to be involved in hookup culture? And they, even though in their heart of hearts, they probably know intuitively, this is killing me inside because these meaningless relationships are hurting me. But intellectually, I can't prove to you that it's wrong, so I'm going to do it. But I think that's really what this is talking about.
Or they're eating the apple.
Or they're eating the apple. If they're not so sophisticated, they're just eating the apple. If they're more sophisticated, they're making an intellectual argument behind why it's okay to drink the wine, right? And it references here the wine of Ahasuerus. The evil urge came about through Adam's sin because afterwards evil became internalized in man. But now it's coming out through Noah's sins, right? And the subjugation to kingdoms, on the other hand, came about from Noah's sin, right? So on the one hand, you have the evil urge is born through Adam, and now the subjugation to different malchuyot happening from the time of Noah. And it says here, this is the second element that makes it more difficult to free the Shekhinah. This story is showing you how the intellect can be abused in order to, again, lock us away from really from engaging with God. The intellect can be something that's used to enhance the human being. But so often, the intellect can be a blockage for the heart to open to God. And this idea of sleeping for 70 years, it's interesting. Rabbi Nachman says explicitly that a 70-year sleep means that one is in such a state of constricted consciousness that he is blocked from all 70 faces of the Torah. And we also know that it could be an allusion to the 70 years of exile in Bavel during the between the first and second temples. And also we know the story from the Gemara of Hanina Me'agel, who slept for 70 years during that Babylonian exile period. And it's significant that this exile was in Bavel, the place where the world was divided into 70 languages. Right, so 70 years, 70 languages. The exile in Babylon was thus meant to rectify Noah's sin. That's a really interesting midrash, and I think we're connecting all this because now it feels a lot more universal. There's something a little bit more childish about like Adam. It's like more childhood oriented, but then now we find ourselves on the world stage with everybody feeling lost and asleep during this you know post Noah era. So I think this is a good time to pause. Just to bring everything full circle, let's read one quick thing from the Tao Te Ching. The spirit that never dies is called the mysterious feminine. Although she becomes the whole universe, her immaculate purity is never lost. Although she assumes countless forms, her true identity remains intact. The gateway to the mysterious female is called the root of creation. Listen to her voice. Hear it echo through creation. Without fail, she reveals her presence. Without fail, she brings us to our own perfection. Although it is invisible, it endures. It will never end. I think this is the Tao Te Ching talking about Shekhinah. And the Shekhinah has been there the whole time. It is with you the whole time. And my blessing to you is as you go into this Pesach, don't feel that you're lost. Feel that you're already found. Even when you can't see it, the Shekhinah is dwelling with you and in you, especially on Shabbat and especially on Pesach. And that's the beracha, that you should feel the inner freedom on Pesach that comes with unlocking all of your egoic complexes and just simply feeling loved and present with the Shekhinah. Baruch Adonai le'olam. Amen ve'amen. Chag Kasher v'sameach, everybody.
Amen.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Alamak.